a really quick and exciting announcement to make. The Menopause and Cancer Podcast is now also on YouTube, and I'm so excited that more people now get to watch our conversations. So the link to the YouTube channel is in our show notes. Please go and subscribe to the channel so that more people who need to hear our conversations are able to find them. Thank you. Welcome to the Menopause and Cancer Podcast, where we speak with cancer patients, survivors, and incredible experts in their fields to help us find solutions to our symptoms and ideas to improve our health. My name is Dani Binnington, and today we're discussing genomic testing for personalized menopause care. What role does testing play in promoting better health is one question I have. And while so many of us know about genetic tests, like the BRCA mutation test, for example, testing in general in our conversations is really on the rise. So many people are wearing their blood glucose monitors to test for their blood glucose levels after they've eaten. But more and more people also talk about genomic testing, and people want to understand their biology. Why are some people better sleeper than others, for example? And how does the food and everything we sort of consume, how are we wired, and how can we use that knowledge to then improve our overall health, especially when we have to address lots of debilitating symptoms if you've been pushed into menopause after a cancer diagnosis. I'm going to talk to an amazing person on this podcast. My friend Toro is also a nutritional scientist and functional medicine doctor. She has used genomic testing and other tests for herself. She's had breast cancer 3 times, and she also uses these tests in her professional experience. And I want to know about everything, because there is also always an emotional impact when we use tests like that. I remember having received my BRCA1 genetic mutation results, and it was a really difficult time for me in my life and also for my family. And so I really want to talk about that aspect as well. If you want to go down the testing route, who do you do it with? What is the provider, and who is the practitioner that can help you understand and make sense of those tests? So let's talk about everything. Let's welcome Toro in. And if you want, we can always talk about many aspects of this in more detail on upcoming episodes. But today is an overview. Let's get on with it. Hello, Toro, and welcome back to the Menopause and Cancer Podcast. You are in a very exotic location today. How are you?
I'm great. I'm in Mexico working remotely, and it's such a pleasure to talk to you. But what's also great is that realizing what's really important for your health and well-being, and simplifying it all when you're traveling or living remotely like I am for a month. And you really forget that sometimes we overcomplicate things. So this is more to simple life.
Yeah. Dare I say, and is it okay to say, you're a breast cancer survivor twice and you are really thriving at the moment?
Three times. And yeah, I am.
And you're thriving. Would you say that? That's okay to say?
Yeah, I definitely say I'm thriving. I think I'm at this point now where I'm 3 years kind of past the last diagnosis. And actually, we're at a point where we're not doing any sort of acute care. It's very much surveillance and observation now, and I have a long-term plan. And for me, that feels actually A, very reassuring, and B, I'm kind of off edge, kind of, if that makes sense. So I'm a little bit more relaxed. I'm like, okay, well, we know where we are. We're all good. There's no evidence of disease at this precise moment. The thing that we've been worrying about has been, you know, we're just going to monitor it. So, and that feels good. It's good to move on.
Thank you. And today I want to talk to you about our genes a little bit more, and about your personal experience with testing, because I think there is a lot more emphasis on personalized nutrition out there. People are wearing their glucose monitors. People have conversations, and I listen to them, and they say, oh, you know, your genes can turn your hunger on and off, and that your genes are responsible for make you feel fuller or for make you feel really ravenous. And so we're talking more about the genes when we talk about food. And then obviously that comes into all of our conversations when people talk about weight loss. Can you talk to us about all of the different genetic tests that are out there? Because I think people are often confused even to what they are, myself included.
So I think there's so many different types of tests, and I think that's the thing, like the oncotype testing and the Prosigna testing and the kind of breast cancer, I mean, if we talk about breast cancer, because obviously there's loads of different cancers and lots of different genes, but there are lots of cancer, there are lots of genes which are connected to particular cancers, which can increase your risk. So when we think about things like BRCA syndrome, BRCA 1 and 2, or Lynch syndrome, which increases like colon cancer, there are lots of, and we know about these, but what we also know is there are lots and lots and lots of genes that we don't know about still. And that we're at the forefront, we're at the very beginning of this kind of education and science. And we will, as time goes on, we won't remember that the Human Genome Project only was happening in 2000, only 24 years ago. So we're still learning and uncovering so much about our DNA and genes. So whilst we map them all out, we don't even know what, you know, 90% of the genes even do. And we know there's a lot of junk, what we call junk DNA, and we don't even know what that encodes for. But it's obviously there for a reason. So it wouldn't be just there if it wasn't necessary. So we're still learning. And I think that, kind of referring back to what you're saying, that we are looking at we're looking at medicine 3.0, as Peter Attia would say. He's a really interesting person that's interested in reducing the risk of long-term disease, chronic disease. But we're still learning so much. And what we can do is use the science as it develops. So one thing we can do is genomic testing. Genomic testing is looking at, we're all individual. You know, we all have our own genes. Even if you're, you know, siblings, you're going to have different genes, you're going to have different information. And I think we have to remember that. And our biological code can impact, you know, how we look, but also how our physiology behaves, whether we can absorb certain nutrients, you know, our reproduction, our neurotransmitters, and how our brain behaves, our kind of influence our well-being. And I think that there are lots and lots of variations in our genetic code. They're called these SNPs, single nucleotide polymorphisms, and they make us all individuals. Now, we will carry these SNPs as family sometimes, or they may be just individual to us. And they don't, it's not about, these little SNPs aren't going to make us ill, and they're not actual, they're not like these BRCA mutations, which can really, you know, confer a huge disadvantage when it comes to, you know, cancer risk. But they're more small little things which can impact our body as a whole. And this will kind of give us a personal health kind of blueprint and for us to understand our own biological strengths and weaknesses. So I think that's really interesting. And we've got a lot of science to understand more about these single nucleotide polymorphisms. And we can do a test now. We're using a simple cheek swab, which A is really easy. You just stick it, you know, like a swab in your cheek, and then you're able to get this information. And we don't have all the SNPs, and we don't have all the information. But what we do know is that learning about this, we can actually influence our nutrition and lifestyle and help to make changes that can help to support our health. So, and that's that field of the intersection between these small genomic changes and nutrition is called nutrigenomics. And I'm really passionate about, you know, all of these things. Epigenetics is how our lifestyle impacts, you know. So it's like they say that the genes may load the gun, but your lifestyle can pull the trigger. So that's what we're kind of learning.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode. 73% of people who listen to my podcast haven't yet clicked the follow button on their podcast player. I want these conversations to reach as many women as possible who might need it. So if you've ever enjoyed this podcast, please hit the follow button now. And I want to talk about that a little bit before I really want to ask you how testing like that can help us now once we've had a cancer diagnosis and initial prevention is a little bit too late for that primary diagnosis for many people. And then we're in the menopause. I want to know about that. So remind me to get back to that. But the quote you've just mentioned is always makes me feel comfortable and not very comfortable at the same time. So for someone who's got a BRCA1 genetic mutation, I know there are many people with the genetic mutation that never get breast cancer or never get ovarian cancer, right? We have a risk and that risk is increased. So my gun is loaded. And sometimes by a quote like that, I feel like, have I done something wrong for the trigger to having gone off? And however, I know cancer is never anyone's fault, and I understand epigenetics, but I also think there are many voices out there who are really talking about how we can really change our lifestyle to reduce our risks and all of that. And yet we can still get cancer with or without a genetic mutation, isn't it? It's just like when you play when you play cards, you want the best hands, you know?
Exactly. It is so luck. And I'll talk to you about some, you know, lack or bad luck. I know somebody very well who has never smoked, has had a healthy lifestyle, has stage 4 lung cancer. And there is nothing she's done. And we keep having this conversation. And she's worked in the architecture building trade. And she's like, do you think I could have been exposed to asbestos? And I think that's, you know, again, that's luck, right? You don't know if you... It's nothing she's done, but it is part of what's happened, her environment and what's happened in life. And, you know, and I have no answers for someone like that. I have no answers. And it's really difficult. And it's absolutely not just to do with... And I see the triggering aspect, as I use the word trigger, for this, you know, like genetics, those are gone. But the thing is, in this instance, we don't know if there's any genetic things prone, or is it just really sheer bad luck? And I think we have to remember that with genes and with DNA, if you think about it, it's like you are photocopying. So you have it all written, your DNA written on a piece of paper, and you keep photocopying it. The more times you photocopy it, the more likely there is that you won't be able to read it. And so that's part of that too. And we have to remember that, unfortunately, things happen. And, you know, do I think my genes, my personal genes, predisposed me? Yeah, they predisposed me to breast cancer now that I know a lot more about it. But did I expect to have breast cancer at 29 when no one in my family has had breast cancer that young? No, of course not. And is that something I did? No, actually, at the, you know, when I was actually diagnosed, super lean, doing all the exercise, you know, eating super well because I already had worked in nutrition and cancer. But you know what, I was there, I had quite a lot of emotional trauma. So there's so many things that happened to us that we have no control over. And I think we need to not get bogged down with that. But then once we do know, there are things we can do to help reduce our risk.
Yeah. And let's talk about that. So before we go back to the testing, I just want to sort of touch on a little bit about how it makes me personally feel with a genetic mutation and what my sort of thought process was always going forward because of it. So when I then did, the doctors found out I had a genetic mutation, I was the first one in our family to get tested. And that felt really important because looking back, it explained a lot of the really sad ovarian cancer diagnoses and deaths we had on my dad's side of the family. Looking forward, it started to worry me. I have 3 daughters. And of course, this is going to open a whole conversation between them and myself and their medical team at one point, if it's relevant and okay for everyone. And then I had a double mastectomy that felt very proactive. I thought, that's great. I'm going to just get rid of my boobs to reduce more cancers. And then I let go of my ovaries. And because I let go of my ovaries, here we are. And we've, you know, the Menopause and Cancer podcast would have never even been launched if that hadn't been part of my journey. And then I thought, what now? I've still got this genetic mutation. I know I've removed those body parts that are at higher risk, but I'm still at risk. That mutation is still in my DNA. And so I think partly I was so passionate about really, you know, really changing my diet and my lifestyle and my stress levels and all of that, because I'm always a little bit feeling under threat. I'm, you know, that feeling. And so conversations with you have always really helped me, because as someone who works in your field, there are so many other options to look at where I'm at and what can science maybe help me to sort of improve and look forward to. So apart from the testing that might tell you you're at an increased risk of cancer, like the BRCA1 test that you've just mentioned and I've just explained, what other tests are there that can help us with where we're at now?
So I think we want to think about kind of the non-medical, because we've moved on from that, because obviously your doctors may offer you some other sorts of genetic testing on your actual tumour, and then that will help for them to understand what the best treatment plan is. So we've moved on from that. This is someone who's finished their treatment. So personally, there's lots of things you could do. And I know lots of people wearing glucose monitors and doing all sorts of gut tests and things like that. I think that stuff is great, but it's not that useful as to your cancer risk and also menopause. I think what's interesting, wearing a glucose monitor, which I think everyone could do without using one of these expensive tests, is to understand how foods personally impact your body and your own blood sugar. So for me personally, I know that I can eat al dente pasta and I won't have that much of a increase in glucose after that. But if I eat white rice, it increases exponentially, and that's not what we want. We want to keep it as level as possible. So for me, wearing a glucose monitor for 2 weeks and just testing some common foods, and actually I realized in that time I never really tested potatoes, but so I need to probably go back and do that. But you know, knowing that eating my sourdough, you know, my kind of sourdough bread that I was having, seeded sourdough bread I was having with eggs or avocado or smoked salmon, whatever it is, had a very gentle glucose release, was actually very useful for me. I'm not saying that is for everybody, but it may be for some people just to understand, you know, what foods impact you in from the glucose perspective. I know that at the moment that's a big conversation. And then the thing I'm particularly interested in is this genomic testing and understanding a little bit about these single single nucleotide polymorphisms, which is what makes us individual. And it has loads of impact on how we, you know, kind of look and how our body behaves. But it's also really, really important for our kind of health and disease risk. So for example, and I'll give you some simple non-cancer related examples, but well, they're kind of cancer related, but for vitamin D. So we have vitamin D receptors and we also have vitamin D transport. So with the genomic testing that I use a company called LifeCode GX, any of the genomic testing in the UK, that's one of the best ones. It looks at you could have a vitamin D receptor that's not working very well. So in which case you'll need to eat more vitamin D rich foods or supplement. You could have vitamin D transport that's not working very well. So it's all very well you absorbing it, but then you're not transporting it around your body where it needs to be. So again, for that reason, you might want to increase the vitamin D rich foods that you have or supplement. So these are the kind of things that we can understand from this genomic testing. And I think that's very fascinating. So for example, there are genes which are related to your sleep. So one's called PER and one's called CLOCK. And essentially they tell you whether you're a night owl or not. If you're a night owl, yeah, which I actually have mutations of both of them. I'm a certified night owl. So, and we know that for those who have shift work, who sleep, you know, go to bed a lot later, it does impact the quality of your sleep. And all of these things can impact other processes in your body. So, for example, those who are doing shift work or like sleeping, you know, kind of going to bed very late and not getting quite enough sleep, that can impact your leptin and your ghrelin hormones. These are two hormones which are very much related to your kind of how much you eat and what you want to eat. So there's the satiety hormone and the hunger hormone, and both of these are impacted when you haven't had enough sleep. So if you know that your sleep is likely to be impacted because of some of the mutations you have. So for example, in my family, we have mutations in how we make melatonin. Melatonin is our sleep hormone. And my whole family, so this is my mum and my dad, which is interesting because they're not related at all, yet they both have the same mutation. And obviously my brother and I, and now my nephew, because we've tested him, have all got this mutation where we don't make enough melatonin, and that impacts our sleep. And we're not very good at getting to sleep. I'm particularly a horrible sleeper. And so everything I do is really to help support my sleep because I'm not making enough melatonin. Now in the UK, you have to be prescribed melatonin. You can't just buy it. In America, you can just buy it in any pharmacy. In fact, in Mexico, it's like America, you can just buy everything. But, you know, you can't, and also you don't want to necessarily supplement melatonin because that can then make you very dependent. So what do? I make sure I eat loads of foods which are rich in tryptophan. So things like turkey and things like that, and chickpeas and things like that. I also take a supplement called 5-HTP, which actually is the precursor of how you make serotonin first and then melatonin to help support my sleep. I have really strict sleep hygiene. I have a very strict sleep routine. So I do the same things in the same order every night just to help get myself sleep. I make sure I sleep with it's very dark. So in my bedroom at home, I've got blinds and curtains, so it's very dark. But when I'm traveling, I just travel with a sleep mask to make sure it's really dark. I need to make sure it's quiet. So all of these things can really impact your health and well-being. Now what's really fascinating is that my nephew has autism spectrum disorder, so he has more issues with sleep. So he is prescribed melatonin at the moment from the doctor to support that, but at some point we want to wean him off and try and help him naturally as he gets older, because I think it's really important. He can't just take melatonin for the rest of his life. So
That is
That's one of the interesting things about it. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, you know what's so interesting about this? I wonder whether we're sort of born and then we're raised in our sort of Western world, and we think everyone needs to be a good sleeper. Good sleep is normal. We think everyone needs to be a good balanced weight. Good balanced weight is normal. We think everyone needs to function in a similar way in their brains. Otherwise, you are on some sort of spectrum, right? Or you are on, you know, a neurodiverse. And we think everything needs to be normal and good, and that's the foundation. But that's not the truth. Like you just said, in your family with your dad, your mother, you, your brother, your nephew now, you actually have a poorer starting point to how well you go off to sleep. And that is just because of how you're made and how you're sort of genetically wired, as to speak, isn't it?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And I think, you know, what's interesting is that when I've always been a poor sleeper, when my mom said that as a baby, I was just awake. I just used to trouble her. Because my brother was actually a good sleeper when he was born and small, when he was younger. Like, he will fall asleep, but it's only as he's got older and he's got more stress that it's more apparent. So these can also show up in very different ways, even though you have the same genes. So I've just, we were born at very different times. I was born in the evening, my brother was born early in the day. And it's fascinating. I just think that, you know, we just don't know how that's going to impact you. So for me, I know that's my nemesis and my weakness. And I was on the phone actually with my nephew, and he hadn't slept very well. It was early in the morning then. I said, "Oh, what's happened? You look tired." He said, "Yeah, I haven't slept." And I just thought, well, yeah. I said, "Oh, have you done this? Have you done this? Have you done?" And we talked about all the different things. He said, "Oh, right, I forgot that." I was like, "Okay, well, maybe you need to make sure remember that, because you know this is training him to be an adult." And so I love that I can have these conversations from now. And more importantly, he's interested and he wants to understand. And obviously he can understand this much. And then he gets maybe in 2 or 3 years, he'll understand this much. When he's 18 and this much, and when 25, so we'll keep talking.
Yeah. And what else did you want to learn from your genetic testing?
So,
what
so
else
we
were
did,
you curious about?
So I was really curious about all of it and how it all works. So I'm really lucky. I'm a trained genomics practitioner. I've been using it as a tool for quite a few years. I work really closely with LifeCode GX. So whenever there's any new training or any new reports, I get to kind of be one of the first ones to be trained. But I wanted to understand, like, what is it in my body that, what could I do? Well, how could I personalize my nutrition? Where do I need to focus my energy? Because you can't do everything. If you did everything, it'd be a full-time job. Like, to self-care, it's a full-time job. I'd literally be doing the gym. I'd be doing sauna. I'd be, 24 hours, I'd be doing things, right? So, or, you know, apart from the sleep time. So I wanted to understand, like, what could I do? And I think for me, what was fascinating is that I knew that I didn't have the BRCA1 or 2 or any of the known mutations. I also knew that my family had some sort of familial breast cancer, but we don't know what genes are involved. We know from the younger women and breast cancer research that there are some families that have women who've had young breast cancer, like when I say younger, I mean under 40, but really under 30 even. And they are from families who have got lots of these single nucleotide polymorphisms, lots of these little genetic mutations, which just make us individual. And we don't know what all of them are, but I wanted to understand that. So that research actually only came out in, I think, 3 years ago, but I'd already done my testing by then. So one of the things that came up is that my mother, and just for context for those who are listening, my mother had breast cancer at 49, which is still relatively young. I had breast cancer at 29, and my father was diagnosed with prostate cancer just before he died, so he would have been 76, so normal age. But what's fascinating from the genomics, and I'm so grateful I got to test my dad before he died, is that I was able to understand not just my history, but also my family's, like, genetics. But every single one of us, myself, my mom, my dad, my brother, my nephew, we've all got mutations in our estrogen receptors. Now, when you think about it, when you have hormone-positive cancers, such as breast cancer and prostate cancer and breast cancer behave very similarly. They're adenocarcinomas. They can be hormone-sensitive. And knowing that we've got these estrogen receptor mutations has been fascinating, but also knowing, there's one more thing. We make three different types of estrogen in our body. Well, actually, there's more than that, three, actually, there's five, but like just generally, we expect three types of, and there's the 2OH version, there's the 4OH version, and the 16OH version. And these are just how they're bonded to the hydrogens. And the 4OH version is actually the most carcinogenic. Now, when you look at the genomic testing, there's a really good report where you can look at your hormones and you can understand kind of your estrogen metabolism, because we have to make estrogen from testosterone and things like that, and progesterone and stuff. Anyway, so I'm kind of making it that 4OH version, my family, all of us have a mutation that we're more likely to make that 4OH version. And knowing that has meant that we can take the steps, all of us, to do things so that we don't move our body away from making that 4OH version and try and make more of the 2 and the 16OH version, which are safer. Now, that for me has been endlessly fascinating. And I try and explain this to my oncologist, but she doesn't quite fully understand. So every time I'm like, okay, well, this is my report. So next time I'll give you an education on this. But you see, there are things you can do. You can think about how your liver works and detoxifies, because all of us, we have to make the estrogen, men and women, we have to utilize the estrogen, and then we have to break it down and remove it from our body. And you can use an analogy I use, and I'm sure I've used this before with you, is the bathtub. You have to fill the bathtub, you have to use the bath, and then you have to let the water drain away from the bath, and then drain away in the pipe so it doesn't get clogged, right? So this plumbing kind of analogy, which I love. So our body has to do all of those things. And what I understand from doing the genomic testing is that some people, including my family, are not very good at making a good form of the estrogen. Like, we make more likely to make the carcinogenic version, but we're also not very good at breaking down and kind of draining away that estrogen. So there are loads of things that we can do to help that. So one of the things about making the 4OH version is you can take a supplement called DIM, which actually the Food Standards Agency has now suddenly classified as a novel food. Before, you could just buy it as a supplement in the UK. Now, at the moment, in the last 4 weeks, it's become slightly a little harder because they've just reclassified it. But it is a product that you can get from eating broccoli sprouts. And I'm obsessed with broccoli sprouts. I think the conversation we have before we got on this call was me and the broccoli sprouts. So broccoli sprouts are like the tiny seeds of the broccoli, which are sprouting, which you can get in health food shops, or you can sprout them yourself. I'm so grateful because I'm traveling and I found the broccoli sprout. So I have a tablespoon every day. But that's one thing you can do if you don't want to, take a supplement, the supplement called DIM. And that, I know, will help my body to make more of this, less of the 4OH version than more of the other ones. Then there's other lifestyle things you can do to help, so I know for me, alcohol and stress are things that push my body one way or another way. So if I have more alcohol, more stress, then I'm making more of the carcinogenic version. I'm also not helping my body to break down the estrogen and remove my body. So for me, that's the key. So I don't drink that much anymore. And actually, it was really, I like to drink, there's nothing wrong with it. But we also know that alcohol, there's no safe amount of alcohol with breast cancer. And particularly with, even with other cancers. So that's one consideration. But the other things, I just don't feel great anymore. So I know that that's something I can easily avoid. Now, the stress is much harder because living in London and, it's a fast-paced life, it is stressful. So then you have to do all the things you need to do to reduce stress, like stress releasing. And I know that the way you and I met was really through yoga, I think, initially. Doing yoga and meditation. So even before, it's pretty early here in Mexico, but even before we had this session booked in, I made sure I do my meditation every single morning religiously, because I know that sets me up for a good day. So it makes me a bit more resilient. I do lots of other practices that help with stress. So one of the things that's really important, so I hope we're not going off topic, by the way, is that hormetic stress are these little stresses that we can put on our body to help us become more resilient to outside stress. So hormetic stresses might be things like sauna and cold plunge, like those kind of things. Doing breath work, certain types of breath work, all of these things create little hormetic stresses, or even eating certain foods, and that can make your body more resilient to stress. So for me, that's really important. Now I know that, I can do more of those things to support my body.
But is it fair to say that there's no point in doing any of these tests alone? Because you said it's a swab in the cheek. Like, it doesn't sound like it's a big deal to do the test, but what do I do with the results if I'm not you need to go through a practitioner, right?
Because you absolutely need to go through a practitioner. How would you know? You can't order the Life Coach EX unless you work with a practitioner and you go through the results. There are other companies which are less scrupulous and they do allow you to just order. But I think like things like 23andMe, you can just order it. But then what do you do with it? What do you know?
Yeah.
Do you know what to do? And I think that's, for me, where we need to have kind of a little bit more structure and control, is so that it's great to have this stuff available and this information available and for it to be freely available, but then how does it impact? And then the other thing we have to say is a lot of the genomic testing and a lot of the data we have is based on white people. The white population only makes up 12% of the global population, yet 93% of the data we have is from white people. So we need more research and data in, you know, the global majority and all ethnic, you know, ethnic groups. And so that's something, there's a doctor that I met a few weeks ago. She's got this massive project, like, where she's trying to fill the gaps, you know, particularly. And so we need more of the data from, you know, Asia. We need more data from Africa, you know, where global majorities live. We need more from Latin America to really understand how our genomics. So at the moment we're working, because obviously we do have ethnic differences. So for example, there's a FUT2 gene, which kind of looks at vitamin B12 and things like that. And there is one mutation that's more prevalent in Asian people, and there's one that's more prevalent in non-Asians. So just understanding all those nuances, and we are still at early days. So A, we need to really fill the gap, these huge gaps, given that most of the data we have is only from 12% of the world population. And we need to make sure that we're using this information correctly, and it's not just, it's been used by people who understand how this works and to can explain and help you.
Yeah, absolutely, because even the genetic mutations for BRCA1 and BRCA2, I think they're available on some of the tests that people can do alone. And I think that is a really scary idea, to have a test result back like this without genetic counseling, without really a doctor to explain to you what you can do about your risks and how you can be screened or what is the next step for you. I think that's a really scary and uncomfortable place, knowing that that exists for me.
Yeah, and I would prefer this all in the healthcare settings, but the way we have some of, and then what I would like is then maybe that everyone who's had cancer is offered that, but they're not. You only offered it if you meet certain criteria. And obviously it is only useful for people like us probably who are younger, because, you know, a lot of the people that are diagnosed with certain types of cancer at older age, it is to do with your DNA not replicating in, you know, in the right way, so it's not in, you know, not replicating properly. So I think we do need genetic counseling. We also need, we just don't have enough of those also available and people trained in that. So I think I'm reading that book at the moment, Yuval Noah Harari one, 21 Lessons for the 21st Century. And I think that's the thing. Our technology has moved so fast. Yeah, we haven't had the time necessary and the resources to train enough people in these new technologies, how we use it. In the same way, AI could be such an amazing tool for us in the healthcare industry, but we need more people trained to know how to use it in a way that's safe for humans.
Yeah.
And all of this stuff is going to work together. We can't avoid technology. We can't avoid these advances that we're making. But what we need is to keep up to date. And I think, sadly, with the NHS, we've got funding issues in the UK. It's not able to necessarily keep up to date, and the private companies are doing much better with it, and they're utilizing these technology and these tools in a much better way. And actually, at some point, it's going to overtake us. So, like, for example, we know that with radiologists, there are not enough radiologists now in the UK, and there is actually a field where less people are qualifying. But we know also that AI could help, and it's just as good as humans at detecting breast cancer when you're looking at mammograms and scans. So that could be a way of, maybe how do we utilize the technology at the same time, so, and, you know, and to help us, because we don't have enough humans to train. And the same thing when it comes to genomic, you know, practitioners, maybe there's ways of training as well to understand, but we do need humans to train it, because it's so nuanced, and what people want to do is more important. And so I think it needs people who are qualified genomics practitioners and nutritionists and whatever to be train the AI to do that. But, you know, we need to have the right information to do that. So, yeah.
It's almost like the next step, isn't it? I think for a lot of people listening, maybe they feel like this is just one thing too many. And for me included, I don't know whether I'm ready, whether I have the energy, the curiosity at the moment to go and embark on testing like that. And I think you need to be in a situation where this is appropriate, isn't it? It needs to be the right time, because what do you then do with the information unless you're ready to make some changes maybe and do some more reading and some more research? I think it needs to be the right time. Is that fair to say?
I think you need to be the right time to make any changes. And I think that's the thing. When is cancer can be a teachable moment, but when is it the right moment for you? So yeah. The cancer diagnosis may have happened, but it's only going to be the right time for you to sort of look at your background. And I will say personally, and I'll own this, that when I was first diagnosed with cancer at 29, I did embark on a personal development journey where I started to look at myself and how I could be differently, both physically and emotionally, mentally. And there's definitely things I tackled, but it wasn't until my second diagnosis or even my third diagnosis, I realized how codependent I was with my mother, and how when she had her breast cancer, that made me into her worrying and caring about her for the rest of my life. And it impacted my own behavior. And I had to break that. And that I could have done at 29, you know, I didn't have the life skills or, you know, and so now I have this, you know, so now that there's a whole new relationship with my mom, which is fantastic. And now, you know, the third diagnosis, it was a completely different type of diagnosis because in the middle of a global pandemic, we were in lockdown. And so I didn't have much choice, but I had to do a lot of it on my own. And there's people could help, but that people didn't know how to because everyone was in survival mode themselves. And so that fear, that abandonment, I've always had a fear of abandonment, but actually being abandoned at that time, you know, really like broke my trust in lots of people. And so that's a whole other kind of emotional set of work that's, you know, need to do. And so I know we've gone a bit off topic, but like I think it's not just about the physical changes that you might need to make, it's the emotional and the mental. And so for me, my peace is the most important thing, my peace and my sleep. And, you know, don't be interfering with those two things. And my exercise, actually, to be fair, I'm not, you know, I'm going to put those things before everything else because I can't do this cancer thing again for a fourth time. I just can't.
Thank you so much for this really big pictured, very holistic view on what science and evidence can teach us, but also what our emotions need to do to catch up and actually endure it all and live with it so that we can live well. One thing can't exist without the other, can it?
No, absolutely. And I think that, I'm trying to do preparing to do a PhD, and one of the things I'm super interested in is how does trauma, like what is the intersection between trauma and estrogen dependent breast cancer in younger women, because we know that stress can really make a difference, and we know, and what's the intersection with diet and lifestyle. And like for me, I'm just really intrigued by that because some of these things are a perfect storm. So physically I'm doing all the right things, yet emotionally, and yet I had this breast cancer at 29. Yeah, I'm super lean, doing triathlons, yeah, eating all the right foods, yet, you know, maybe I had drunk more alcohol in my 20s, maybe had some like severe emotional trauma. So again, like just going back to the very beginning of this conversation, a lot of it's about luck. We don't know, our life path is what happens to us, and there's so much of it we can't control. And for those people who have a cancer diagnosis and want to control it all, there has to be a point where you learn to let go, and that you can only look after so many things, and you'll come to those things. You can't change everything either. So almost you need to trust the universe and relax into it and find the things that you can do and do them one by one, because any sustainable change, when I talk to any of my patients about any sustainable change for health, you can't change everything at once, and you've got to embed one habit before you start on the next habit. And I think that's really important, is like looking at the sustainable changes and creating habit change, but one by one.
I couldn't finish this conversation in any better way, Toru. It's always a pleasure. Every time I speak to you, I learn so much, so much. And yeah, if I ever embark on genomic testing, I'd be knocking on your door.
Please do. You know I'm always here for you.
Thank you so much. How are you? I hope you're not more confused than before this conversation. But it is a bit confusing, isn't it? There are so many tests and there are so many things we could do, and so many people around us are doing lots of different things. And so it can feel like we're almost missing out if we don't embark on different tests or finding out how our biology works. But I want to say to you today is if you are feeling confused, or if you think you should be doing more or something else, or try a test or do this or that, then really think, what is your gut feeling telling you to do? Do you really want to inquire, or do you just have a bit of FOMO, fear of missing out? And that is why you want to embark on inquiries like that. Because we don't always have the energy, we don't always have the financial resources, and quite frankly, we don't always have the knowledge of what practitioner to use to embark on tests like that. So walk away from this conversation and really think, is there something you want to act upon? Or maybe nothing. Maybe it's just been an interesting conversation to listen to, and that is it for you today. And I think that's exactly how we need to navigate this post-cancer survivorship menopause landscape, because there are so many people around us doing lots of things, and it can make us feel that we're not doing enough. But let me reassure you, just by being here, by listening to our conversations, by being part of this amazing community, you are doing more than enough and so much more than other people. Now, please go and share this podcast with all of your cancer nurses, your oncologist, your surgeon, all of the people in your healthcare team that you come in contact with, so that other people who haven't stumbled upon us can also use our resources. That is more than enough. Thank you for being here, and I can't wait to tune back in and chat to you next week.